Thank you, Governor. And as we move into our program, I think it's appropriate that we acknowledge the intersection between the role of sovereign states and nations and the role of international agencies, as we're going to focus on now in looking at ongoing challenges to food security. But do that, I think, in the way the Governor has highlighted, that remembering this is, at the end of the day, a human, an individual problem that we're trying to address and deal with there. We have five panelists that are going to be speaking. I'll introduce each of them as they come up to speak, but the first is Henk-Jan Brinkman. I'll introduce him momentarily. After that, we'll be followed by Jim Cornelius, the Executive Director of the Canadian Food Grains Bank, Christopher Delgado, the Coordinator of the Global Food Response Program at the World Bank, Joe Dubray, the Senior Agricultural Policy Analyst at the OECD, and finally Robert Patterson, the Senior Liaison Officer for the FAO. In putting the panel together, my co-moderator, Ali Shadi, is here as well, and he'll be making some concluding comments as we wrap up. With that, let's move to the first of our speakers, Mr. Henk-Jan Brinkman, Senior Advisor for Economic Policy, the United Nations World Food Program. Mr. Brinkman has held positions as the Chief of Economic Analysis and the Chief of Food Security Policy and Markets in the Office of the Executive Director of the World Food Program in Rome, was a Senior Economic Affairs Officer in the Executive Office of the Secretary General of the United Nations, where he advised the Secretary Generals and Deputy Secretaries Generals on economic, social, and environmental issues. He has written widely on issues related to food security and the global economy, and I'd ask you all to please join me in welcoming Henk-Jan Brinkman.
Thank you very much. How much time do I have?
The moderator has failed in his first roll. Let's say 12 to 15 minutes.
I'll try to keep to that. A few key messages I would like to relay. The first one is that the food crisis is not over, and the global economic and financial crisis has even worsened it. Over the last year or so. And now we have a billion people hungry and more than 2 billion people suffering from micronutrient deficiencies. Hunger has broadened and it has deepened over the last year. The impact of these crises are long-term because of the impact of malnutrition on young children in particular. There's some green economic shoots, but there are very few social ones, and some of the social indicators, such as unemployment, is still worsening, and that is likely to affect hunger and malnutrition as well. And there is a need for an urgent and comprehensive response, as previous speakers have also highlighted already. Food access is determined by prices and incomes. And over the last few years, we have seen vulnerable households being hit by those two determinants on both sides. First, the food prices coping mechanisms have been eroded, and then you get a second shock in the global financial crisis that mostly affected incomes. If you spent 10% of your income on food, on doubling of food prices might not mean much. But if you spend 50 to 80%, as many of the poor households in the world do, then that even a 10 or 20 or 30% increase is a major shock. And this is what happened. Prices of food started to increase very slowly since about 2001. In 2006, first we saw a bump in the maize price. In 2007, we saw a soaring of wheat prices, and then in 2008, finally, rice prices. They came down quite dramatically, in particular rice, but they're still relatively high. And they're particularly high at the local level. As you can see in these numbers from the FAO, our sister organization in Rome, in countries of Sri Lanka and Mauritania and Peru, and these are just three examples, from three different continents. Prices have always been higher than international prices and declined as well, but not as much as at the international level. Our own research, we monitor food prices at the local level as well, show that about two-thirds of the countries we monitor, the cost of the food basket, of the staple food basket, is still more than 20% above the five-year average. And in some countries, it's 50 or even 100%. Now, what happens when prices increased? Families start to cope. And they cope first by cutting the cheaper and the more expensive and the more nutritious food out of their diet. But they also take children out of school and they sell assets and sometimes productive assets. And that has a long-term impact. But on the food side in particular, we are very concerned about the impact on malnutrition because of the cutting to lower quality foods. And in the end, going down this bar to the right, they also cut down on the number of meals and the quantity of food and the caloric intake. And ultimately, that leads to child malnutrition and even death. And these consequences, let me first talk about this. This is showing exactly what I just described in Bangladesh, where when rice prices go up, families try to maintain their rice caloric consumption intake, but they cut down on the green leafy vegetables and the animal protein. And that has the important effect on the underweight of children. And if that happens before the age of two, you see that a child in Bolivia, the lower green line, are stunted at the age of 24 months. And when you're stunted at the age of two, you're basically stunted for life. And that has huge implications for healthcare, for health, the rest of your life, for education, the educational attainment. The brain does just not develop as well because of the lack of the proper nutrients, and therefore learning is affected. And all in all, it means higher productivity is lost because of that. A recent research in Guatemala showed that children who had a nutritious drink 30 years ago, they tracked all the children down after 30 years. They found out that the children who had this nutritious drink compared to the children who did not have wages 46% higher. And that is taking account of other factors. WFP did 40 assessments in 2008 to make sure that we have a good understanding of what actually is happening on the ground in households on food consumption, food security. And we found widespread evidence of this shift to lower quality foods and in the end also in a reduction in quantity of food. We also found increases in dropout rates and the selling of economic assets in some of these countries. What is also very interesting is this new phase of hunger where we found evidence on that, for example, the absolute impact in towns was even higher than in rural areas, but the severity because of the poverty levels were higher to begin with in rural areas. The impact and the severity was much bigger in rural areas. Also, salaried workers, who we always expected were better off in towns, were very much affected. And we see that again in the current economic and financial crisis. Food prices are likely to remain high because of some structural factors and then increase again over the next 8 years or so because of climate change, because of the demand for biofuels and the low productivity growth that we have seen and talked about over the last few days, which will take some time to correct. After higher food prices, we suddenly got a financial crisis on our lap. And this is, for example, what happened with World Trade. It basically fell from a cliff. And we saw similar numbers in terms of global capital flows. And as a Mexican minister at one point said in a UN meeting, this time it's not us. It started in developed countries, but then it spread very quickly to developing countries and then to household levels, and then the impact on the household level is in terms of health, education, and food security. We decided not to do a large number of assessments this year. We did 5 case studies, we found very clear evidence of how the global crisis spread to the household level. Exports went down and led to job losses in export-oriented sectors. Remittances, a really big concern because it's such an important coping mechanism for vulnerable households, are down, and it is a decline at the global level for the first time in years of about 7% this year. Exchange rate went down, which makes food imports and agriculture imports, for example, inputs more expensive. And the coping mechanisms, we also already see efforts to diversify income sources, withdrawing children from school, and again, reducing the number of meals and eating less nutritious food. The response, the topic of this particular panel, was first in March of last year, we issued an extraordinary appeal because of the higher food and fuel prices. It was more difficult for the World Food Program to provide food assistance. We asked for $755 million and we got $1 billion, partly because of a generous gift from Saudi Arabia, which took care of half of that $1 billion. And the total budget, the total amount of money we raised last year was $5 billion. We spent about 3/4 of that to cover the higher food and fuel costs that we had to deal with, and about 1/4 to the new face of hunger, of increases in hunger and malnutrition, in particular, for example, in urban areas. And we provided food assistance to about 31 million people in 26 countries. And school feeding was an important tool that we used because it was a safety net that was available in many countries already. It is much easier to use a safety net and scale it up than to create a new one when there is a shock. So it was easy to provide more food, take-home rations, or keep the schools open, for example, during vacations. But we did in about 17 countries and reaching about 5 million beneficiaries. But other activities included the supplementary nutritious food, food for work programs as part of safety nets, providing particular targeted food to the urban poor and hungry in about 19 countries. And then we used a number of innovations. We got the executive board of WFP approving a new strategic plan that broadened the baskets of tools that we have to address hunger and malnutrition. For example, we rapidly increasing the number of cash and vouchers that we use, rather than giving them food in kind, if the markets operate, if the capacity is available, and if there's no strong inflationary in the country, cash and vouchers is a good way to address food insecurity. And by the end of last year, we were operating cash and voucher programs in 24 countries. New nutritious foods in about 17 countries. And we're using, for example, a little product like this, MixMe, which is a little sachet with micronutrient powders. Very cheap, only 2 cents. And children need this only one every other day. Index-based weather insurance. Other colleagues of mine have talked about that. Purchase for Progress, happy to hear some mention it already. We have a huge procurement footprint in the developing world. We buy more than 1 million tons in developing countries, but to increase the impact on smallholder farmers and help the development of markets and make it able for smallholder farmers to access markets, Purchase for Progress is an important initiative that is being rolled out quite rapidly. But we are concerned. We are concerned because we have a work program of $6.7 billion for this year, and we only have raised 2.6. ODA has gone up over the last few years, but the focus on food assistance and nutrition assistance as a percentage of ODA is actually declining, and it's only 3% over the last few years. And global food aid deliveries are down as well, from about 15 metric tons in 1999 to a little bit more than 6 metric tons at the global level last year. I'm sorry? Million. I said a billion?
No, you said 15.
15 million in metric tons in 1999, yes. So I would end with a plea to focus on food and nutrition assistance for those who lack access to food, and in particular on nutrition. It has come up a couple of times. There was a panel of economists asked where they would spend the money on if they would get $75 billion to spend. And half of the top 10 priorities was focusing on nutrition interventions, such as vitamin A supplements and food fortification, and interventions like this. The vitamin A investment, for example, $60 million per year would yield a return of $1 billion per year, and that's a return of 17%, 1.7. That's much better than any return on Wall Street of late. Thank you.